Good evening, one and all. Yes, a Wednesday, made it halfway through another week. But this is me, Barry, with another book and a chat. Well, I love all the historical stuff on TV, from sort of the hunting for treasure to the sort of hidden things and mysteries about people and everything like that. My guest today, well, a lot of his stuff is historical. But there's also some other bits along the way. His alternative history and some non-fiction stuff. In fact, he's written nearly 50 books, including several New York Times bestsellers. What's the series? It'll come back to me. Never mind. Anyway, his trilogy, and this is it. Now, the brain has gone. I might as well give up for the rest of the show. His famous trilogy, which I will come back to me in time, was on the New York Times best-selling list for a long time. Oh dear. 12 weeks, in fact. The sequel was the original one. 1 second after, one year after, and The Final Day. That was the story. The John Matheson. That was it. I knew it was something like a brewery. John Matheson series. But it wasn't just the first. He'd written loads of stuff before then. And also, I don't want to talk to him towards the end of the show about this. There's something on the historical side that he's interested in that I want to ask a couple of questions about. Not only that, by the way, also the books. He's introduced us to some things which, in the past, one might call science fiction. Now, we're not so sure about, and the fear of what might happen through them is also imminent, a lot of people might say right now. But he's got a new book out, so we're going to talk about that as well. But better introduce him first, haven't I? Because on the show today, I have the one and only William R. Fulton. Hi, William. How are you doing?
I'm enjoying the opening.
Oh, my God. I my brain just turned off then. I got it here. It's sitting in front of me in half inch high letters, and I can't see it for looking at it. But it's funny. It's like what I did say to you, but when I start the show, there's like a dashboard on the computer that comes up, and there's this great big round button about 2 inches round in the middle of the dashboard that says start. And you have to click this, and it's a good 2 inches round in the whole screen. And you have to click that to stay start. Because if you don't, the two of you can hear each other, but it doesn't go out on the air. Now, you'd have thought that a big 2-inch button I could see. But no, at least 3 times I've forgotten to click the blessed thing. Well, luckily it records it, and we can put it out at a later date. But anyway, yes, back to you. History has always been a very big part of your life, I know. And, you know, right from some of your earlier books about the American Civil War, in a way, some of them were, but a different part of it. And I've come across this in a couple of other books. African American regiments, was it Battle of Crater or something like that they fought in?
Yes, that was actually my doctoral dissertation.
Oh, really? Right.
Was on the 28th United States Colored Troops, who were recruited out of Indiana and were pretty well annihilated at the Battle of the Crater, July 30th, 1864. And then from that, I went on to write a young adult novel, which won a couple of awards.
Right.
So that was my life went into that.
Was that film, was that the battle that the film was based on?
No. That, Glory is based on the 54th Mass.
Right.
Which went into service a year earlier.
Because I also came across a regiment of women who fought in the American Civil War or something like that. Have you come across that?
There might have been some women in uniform, but...
Right.
Either really doing great jobs as nurses or... We won't discuss the other thing.
Right, okay, yeah, I know. Yeah. Every war has them. Right. Okay, so you went on from that. I mean, and you, I always say to people, you know, what, you try dipping your toes in other things, and that, and you did with your what was it, pillar to the sky, space elevator.
Mm-hmm. I've been fascinated with space elevators. Gosh, ever since Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book about it around 40 years ago.
Right, I can remember. I'm that old. I can remember it.
Yeah, Pillar to the mine's called Pillar to the Sky. I can't remember Clarke's book.
Right.
But about 5 years, 6 years back, NASA invited me to come up to Goddard, poke around for 3 or 4 days, cook up my journal, and go for it. And I did. And when I first sent the manuscript, the proposal in, the response back was way too futuristic, Bill. And I said, hey, listen, I based all the facts on tests you guys did 10 years ago. Oh, really? Okay, go for it.
Right, yeah.
That was a fun book.
Well, of course, then, you know, with all the other bits and pieces, along came the John Matheson series. It wasn't initially called that, was it? I mean, it's just, it ended up as a trilogy, and that's what it became. But I think it was One Second After was the first one, if I remember right.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, see, that brings into mind, interesting what you said about, you know, this has been around for a long time, the electromagnetic pulse weapon.
Yes.
To me, that brings the whole thing about Tesla and did the government steal his plans for the sort of pulse-type defense and the whole electronics business. Is that sort of, did you sort of look into that part at all?
No, EMP is generated quite simply by detonating a relatively low-yield nuclear weapon, that's a PK.
Oh, okay.
Send it 250 miles up over the central United States, pop it, and it sets up an electromagnetic disturbance that cascades through the atmosphere, intensifies, hits the wiring of our infrastructure and blows it all out. And 1 second later, the lights go out.
Hence 1 second after being the title of the first book. Now, a lot of people, to start with, it's just ridiculous, far-fetched, but it's not, is it?
No, you know, when the book first came out in 2009, I based it my research on the congressional studies that were done in 2004 and 2008. And I was urged by some people I know in Congress to write a novel to convey the reality as a story.
Uh-huh.
But when this came out, I had interviewers all but saying to me I was wearing a tinfoil hat. It's all changed now, and on this particular day, I'm really delighted because on March 26, President Trump signed an executive order to start hardening our grid to protect it from an EMP strike. I've waited 10, 15 years to see that done.
Wow.
Finally, on March
26. Because he just signed for the start of the Space Troops or the Space Corps or something, didn't he, as well?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I forget who said it, that what it looks to be magic at the start and then becomes, well, high technology one day becomes ordinary.
Right.
And we look at all the comforts we have in this world. Think of what somebody from 500 years ago would say. This is impossible. This must be magic that these machines move by themselves.
Yeah.
So, EMP is a real threat. It's been realized ever since the early 1960s when we and the Russians both detonated a nuke out in space, and suddenly there was this massive electrical overload. In fact, the American one was blowing out circuits 500 miles away.
Wow.
So it's real. It's really real.
It's essentially what you say, and I sort of brought this up myself in the past. You go back to when Star Trek first came out, And everything was so far-fetched on Star Trek. You know, it was future and now it's beyond. Okay, so they had sliding doors. Now, nearly every supermarket everywhere's got sliding doors. And you had communicators, mobile phones, captain's log, tablets. And the only thing we haven't got is the sort of materializer thing. And by all accounts, they're working on, the transporter. And by all accounts, they're working on that now as well.
Well, when I got my first cell phone, it was a flip-up, like Captain Kirk.
Exactly. That's what it was. It was.
There's any number of times I flip it open and go, bridge.
Exactly. Exactly.
Scotty, get here quick.
But it's funny how, as you said, things like that, which were, it's imagination, it's magic, you know, it just isn't. And this is what with the EMP part of it is. And now, of course, in your new book, it's not a man-made type of EMP that causes the trouble. It's actually the whole of Earth is being attacked by a natural phenomenon.
Solar event.
Yeah.
What are known as CMEs, coronal mass ejection, was first realized by a British astronomer 150 years ago named Carrington, who observed storms on the surface of the sun, and 2 days later, the Victorian internet blew out, meaning the telegraphy system. Considering how heavily built those systems were compared to today, fortunately, we've not been hit by a major CME since then. But then I wrote about a different type of storm called a coronal proton eruption. If that ever hit us when the magnetosphere had already been disturbed by a CME, it could turn into an extinction-level event, meaning
wow.
The vast majority of life on this planet would die from a massive overload of radiation within a matter of minutes. That was a grim story to write.
Right, I bet. Wow.
What I wanted to try and convey was, part of it was about the fact I was very angry. I mean, I'm watching fellow Americans tear this country apart. And if this type of event happened, we would realize on those last couple of days just how foolish most of the things we're arguing about really are. There's a lot more that binds us than should divide us.
Yeah.
And also this belief, life really is miraculous. And we should take a little more time to take a deep breath and look at it. So I'm writing about how humanity might be facing its final 48 hours.
Right. And this is, is it a first in a series of this, or is it just a standalone?
That's still up in the air, but at the moment, my publisher keeps saying, "Gee, can we have another?" And I'm like, I'm really burned out on this subject.
Right, I was going to say, this happened, it's got through it. What do you want? What happened? What happened next?
Well, a local newspaper did an article on me a couple of years ago, and it was on the front page, and the title of it was Dr. Doomsday.
I mean, people might say that. Others might say, you're the voice of reason. Yeah, you're seeing the stuff that could affect us, and something like this could affect us. And
yes.
As you say, within the book 48 hours, if this happens and we're not prepared for it, that's it, basically.
That's it. Game ender.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
a very small percentage would survive in deep shelters, but that would be it.
Yeah. Because it would be. In your book, the whole of Earth has to work. The population of the world has to work together.
Yes,
and that's the big thing, I'd have thought.
That's part of my point. All the things that divide us within America, or Russia, China, United States. What would we say to each other if there's only 2 days left? I think there'd be a hell of a lot of, you know, what we were arguing about before was kind of stupid.
Yeah.
So I hope that's a bit of the message that's getting out there.
Now, the Earth is going to be hit by a CME.
Yes.
And
we're hit quite frequently, actually. We just got hit the other day.
Is that where people blame sunspots? Is that a similar thing? Because, yeah, people say, oh, we used to always say in the old days, we've got television's not working, must be a sunspot.
Yes.
Right.
CMEs erupt off of sunspots on a regular basis. We get hit by them every week or two, but there's a grading system for them, just like tornadoes and hurricanes, like level one, level two.
Oh, okay.
And different frequencies. And what we've been hit by are really rather low-level storms. Now, 4 or 5 years back, we got hit by what was initially a G3, which is rather high. I was in Iceland at the time, fortunately, because I saw the greatest aurora borealis of my life. And it was disrupting air travel and...
Oh, yes, yes. I remember the air travel being disrupted, yes?
Yeah, you have to fly at a far lower altitude because of if one of these is going on and you're up there at 40,000 feet, you're getting dosed.
Right.
So you have to put more atmosphere between the plane and space. And if it gets really bad, it can actually disrupt transatlantic travel. But that hasn't happened in quite a few years.
Right. Because of that, the Earth basically, to save them, they have to turn everything, they have to press one switch to turn everything off around the world.
Powering down the grid in the event of a CME is crucial. Regarding a CPE, that's a lot more intense. It almost wouldn't matter.
Right.
People are going to be killed. Fortunately, with a CME, we got about 2 days' warning, and it would require browning out most of the electrical system, in fact, shutting some of it off so it doesn't overload when the CME hits. But it would be very disruptive for weeks, most likely.
Have we had something like that back in the 60s, 70s?
Quebec got hammered rather hard and was 88 or 89. It did blow down their grid for a while.
I'm an IT person. I seem to remember there something was discussed about something like that, and I can't remember what. Perhaps it was Y2K or something. I can't remember, but just
point. Well, there was a couple of big power failures in New York in the 60s and the 70s.
Right.
And that shows you what could happen in just 12 to 24 hours without electricity.
Imagine. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Just think of the breakdown. Yeah, as in always these days, there'd be a total breakdown of society, I'd have thought.
Yeah, I just maybe to make it slightly humorous, a couple, 3 days back, I saw an article on most expensive penthouse in New York up for sale, and it's in that tower that small, square, kind of ugly-looking tower that's about 100 stories high. And they wanted like $10 or $12 million for it. And all I could think of was, yeah, that looks great, but what happens if the power goes off?
Right!
You're going to have to hike 100 floors carrying a bucket of water.
Nah.
That house will be useless.
Yeah, I know. So obviously this is after the success of the trilogy. Have people been chasing you for this, for a new book on this sort of thing? Or, have you had this in mind for a while?
When I wrote One Second After, I wrote it as a standalone. I thought I was done with the subject. I wanted to sort of return back to writing history. And suddenly it takes off as an NYT bestseller.
Right.
So, as Michael Corleone says in The Godfather, every time I try to get out, they pull me back.
Right.
And they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. So I went on to write 2 more books on the subject.
Right. And now you've done it again. Right.
Well, I've done one more on CME, and I'm really a historian at heart.
Right.
I never saw myself getting into technological thrillers, but that's kind of what happened. It's where fate led me.
Now, the book's been out since, what, January? How's it doing so far?
48 hours? Yeah, it's been out since January. It's doing good, but it's not doing great the way One Second After did. I think because it's a bit more of a tougher subject of humanity is facing an end game and how we're going to deal with it. That does upset a couple of people. Mm. I have types of reviews. I have the 5-star reviews that this book really made. I've even had a couple of people say it changed their life. It really made them think.
Right.
And then I got some 1-star reviews going, boy, that was depressing. I never want to read his stuff again.
It's interesting. I saw one of the reviews was by Steve Berry, who was on the, you know, he's a regular on the show each year. He comes on.
Yeah.
He was on the show a few weeks back, him and I talk on the sort of history side and the things that could have been and might have been and we don't know about and everything like that. And there is so much we don't know, or so much that we do know but we're not told, and things like that. We're all, every day, something new's being discovered and something's being forgotten. And it's very hard with everything that this world, we think we know everything, but we know so little.
Yes. That's the fun of being a historian.
Exactly. Now, talking about history, I did say at the start, there was a question I was going to... Because I saw, I think I read somewhere, that you're into... archaeology, but
yes,
in a certain area is your favorite area. Is that correct?
Mongolia.
Now, are you hunting for the heart of the Khan?
No.
You're not.
I've been on 4 expeditions to Mongolia. We were digging at a location called Habalgas, which was a city from the Oyghurs from the 8th century.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding Genghis Khan's lost grave and treasure, I hope they never find it.
Oh, crikey, yes.
The Russians tore a whole area apart looking for it. The Mongols were just sort of smilingly misleading them whenever they could.
You can just imagine, yeah.
Their national mythology. And I was on a plane the first time with a team that was being supported by University of Chicago, and they were all boasting. They knew where it was. They were going to go get it. My friends and I were just like, yeah, right. They got kicked out of the country a week later.
Really?
Well, they claimed that this burial mound might be it, and they took a bulldozer to it.
Seriously?
Of course they're going to get thrown out.
Oh yeah. We were given permission to do it. Yeah, we got the documents.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Right.
That is part of the mystique of Mongolia and the stories of Genghis Khan.
Right. Isn't there is that the one with it? No. What's the one where it was in the river? Was his the thing where it was in the river? Or no, it's different. I'm getting muddled up with some of these. But yeah, there's this whole thing about, you know, his burial and everything, which I think it's great that you have these characters. And you don't want the stuff to be found, because then the mystique, if it ever existed, but the mystique will go then. So it's great that they keep trying but don't find this stuff.
Yep, and there's so much yet to be found. But also, I just love the culture of Mongolia. I spent a lot of time traveling with nomads and herders, nomadic herders.
Right.
Which is a culture that is sadly dying out because of the cell phone and television and all of that. The Mongol culture is shifting away from the nomadic life.
But see,
so
that's...
when I was there...
Go ahead, sorry. Yeah.
When I was there in 2000, it was not that many years after the Soviets finally left. And it was sort of like almost like a back to the land movement in Mongolia of people trying to pick up the way of life of their ancestors. And Oh gosh, it was so fascinating traveling with them.
But see, that's one of the things that makes, in a way, their history so hard, and there isn't, because it's a nomadic history. So that these places that were once, you know, major, supposedly major cities, yeah, so it was a stopping spot. Yeah, they were always on the move, so it's very hard. And these places just don't exist anymore, do they? I would have thought for a lot of them, like the one you went to look at, when you went there. You said
Habalgus was a center of the Silk Road in the 8th century, 9th century. There's even a description of it from a Chinese source. And it covered quite a few acres. The walls were still intact.
Yeah, I think I saw something about it on a TV thing. And they're big, huge, thick walls. I mean, it must have been massive in this time.
And you run a metal detector along the outside of the wall. Beep, you pull out an arrowhead. Beep, you pull out another arrow. The Mongols took the place around the year 1200. Not many people survived that.
Right, I bet. Amazing. Well, it's been fascinating chatting with you, not just because of your books, but obviously the history part as well, which I love. But the success of the new book, The 48 Hours, and obviously the other series, you keep going. But time is beating us, so what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you, William, so you can tell everybody where they can find more about you, your books, and, of course, your latest, 48 Hours.
48 Hours, as they used to say, better bookstores anywhere or Amazon. The same with the John Matheson series and Pillar to the Sky and a lot of stuff I've written. You can get on Amazon. So, or good old fashioned bookstores.
That's great. Well, William, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. It's been great chatting to you. Good luck with the books in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there you go. My guest today, William R. Forstchen, Forstchen. And we've been talking about several of his books and series, including his new one, which is a latest, which is a single so far, as he says, but pressure's on, called 48 Hours. And you can find him, as he says, all over the place. Just look on the line, look on for the various books, and there's sort of pages about him and that all over the place, including, I might say, Wikipedia. So you know he's pretty big New York Times bestsellers if he's got his own Wikipedia page. Well, that's it. Now, I will be back, the shows will be back for a couple of weeks, including, of course, my music shows at the weekend. Those were the days and the British invasion on a Sunday here on New Visions Radio. But I am going back to England for a couple of weeks, so I'll see you again in about 2-3 weeks' time. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget.